From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we speak with our friend in Esteli, Nicaragua, just outside Managua, Stephen Sefton, formerly known as Tony Solo here at CPR. And we're going to continue our conversation, which has kind of been ongoing over the years, but we've been focused particularly over the last couple of weeks, on what seems to be like the mad dash by the U.S., maybe accelerated during the Biden administration since January, to not just hold off any of these countries exercising their right of self-determination and sovereignty and such against the U.S. and Monroe Doctrine, et cetera, but pushing way back hard, trying to recapture their lost glory. And I have no idea where this heads, because when we look around the world at places like Taiwan, a lot of it looks like war. And I'm assuming there's going to be some pushing back in the Latin America Caribbean region as well. You want to talk about all that?
Yeah, and there's a lot to talk about, and it's very, very complicated. But and perhaps if we could have a look at one or two of the things, the most salient things that are going on in the region at the moment, and maybe later on we could try and look at underlying themes that perhaps are more important than the week-to-week events that we generally talk about. Uh-huh. One of the things that's happening in the region at the moment is that we're coming up for elections. So they're going to be legislative elections in Argentina. They're going to be regional and municipal elections in Venezuela. And they're going to be general elections, presidential and legislative elections in Nicaragua. And those elections all happen in November. And so, as you'd expect, there's quite a bit of interest from the United States and the European Union, who are trying to intervene in different ways to affect the outcomes of those elections. And that's kind of a reflection of what we've been talking about in our earlier conversations. For example, last week, and I think the week before, we were looking at the way the United States and the region is going through this kind of quite complicated and difficult to decipher period in which the United States and its allies in the European Union countries are trying to prevent a further collapse of their influence in the region, because over the last few years they seem to have quite a strong hold in the region via the right-wing governments of Jair Bolsonaro, Mauricio Macri, Sebastian Piñera, and others, especially Iván Duque, of course, in Colombia. It looked for a while as though the people who were talking in about some kind of conservative restoration might have been onto something. But as you and I argued, the underlying reality of the lived experience of the impoverished majority in the region was always going to roll back any short-term right-wing gains in terms of government in the region.
Well, we said that was inevitable, right? Because the right-wing recaptures government. They go right to the same program that brought the left to power in the first place, which is to basically impoverish everybody, steal what's not nailed down, try to blame somebody else, and then go to the polls. And so people say, no, we don't like that. We like the fact that they built a million new apartments during the last president's term. We're reelecting them, et cetera, et cetera. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but yeah. And we're talking, November 7th in Nicaragua, November 14th in Argentina, and November 21st in Venezuela. And I don't know, Maduro seems really frightened about the elections there. He said, I'm going to sit in my armchair with popcorn on November 21st to watch Juan Guaido vote.
Right. Yeah. Pass the popcorn.
Go ahead. Okay. Right. Go ahead. Yes.
So and that was obvious to anybody with a head on their shoulders. Back in 2016, 2017, 2018, and you can see that the United States' response to the fact that they knew perfectly well that they can't maintain the grip that they historically accustomed themselves to have of neo-colonial control of the region's resources. Because that's the key, as you put right. it, and steal anything that isn't nailed down. And that's the US and European and right-wing agenda in the region of Latin America and the Caribbean. Yeah. And so then what we saw was Andrés Manuel López Obrador won the presidency in Mexico. Alberto Fernández, together with Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, won the elections in Argentina. You saw Pedro Castillo make that historic win in Peru. And the only real setback was, in terms of the elections progressing through the region, was the fact that Guillermo Lasso won, squeaked in Ecuador. And he's gone ahead and imposed exactly as you just described the same old right wing agenda. Before we go on to what's happening in specific countries, and the overall trend has been that the U.S. grip on the region that looked as though they might be able to consolidate again under these right wing regimes from 2016 to 2019. That's broken up, and it's breaking up, and it's very difficult to see a clear pattern at the moment of what's going to take shape over the next 3-4 years. And these elections in Argentina, Venezuela, and Nicaragua will give us a good idea of how the trends are going. And it looks as though, in Venezuela's case, the governing United Socialist Party of Venezuela, led by Nicolas Maduro, is going to do very well in the regional and municipal elections. Perhaps not as well as they'd like, but we'll see. And the fact is that the mere fact that the elections are being held and that the opposition are taking part in them is a huge win for President Maduro and his and his government and his party, because the effort, everybody should be well aware now of what the United States and its allies have subjected Venezuela to over the last 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah.
Intense sanctions that would have flattened and overthrown any other government. But because President Maduro has genuine popular support, broad and deep popular support
right.
across Venezuela, he's been able to sustain the country's economy. He's been able, for example, they've continued their program of social housing that you mentioned
right.
Yourself right. just a minute ago. And I've forgotten the number of free homes, furnished homes that they've built and handed over to low-income people, and I think right. it's over 2 million.
Right, that's right. It's at least 2 million. I remember the 2 million mark. Yep.
Yeah, so and so
that's huge, and especially the size of that country.
Yeah, and their population is what, 28, 29 million?
Yeah, just shy of 30 million, yeah. Yeah, here's 2 million units. One in 15 human beings, men, women, and children, get a brand new apartment. That's an, right. an amazing feat.
A brand
under
new
sanctions.
Furniture.
Under sanctions.
Yeah, under sanctions. And so, and now what the, and despite everything, thanks to their strategic alliance with China, they're developing strategic alliance with Russia, and they're developing relationship with Iran. Iran, last week when we were talking about Venezuela's relationship with Iran, I forgot to mention that Iran has been directly involved in assisting the Venezuelan oil company, PDVSA, to retool and bring its facilities back online, facilities that had been offline because they hadn't been able to get the parts to do the necessary maintenance. And Iran helped them with that. And they're now
yep.
increasing their oil production. And I think they're up to around 700,000 barrels a day, something like that.
And what's significant about that is Iran just got admitted into the SCO. They're like huge. Just one thing for perspective on those 2 million housing units in Venezuela. In the United States today, as of June 16th, I'll say, of this year, there were 958,000 public housing units in the whole country. Venezuela built twice as many as that for a country of one-eighth the population of the United States in the past 5 years.
Right, and if you start looking at countries like Nicaragua, for example, and there was a poll done the other day of support for Daniel Ortega's government and his FSLN Sandinista party in the west of Nicaragua, and they have around 79% support.
Yep.
No, and why? Because they have revolutionized the country's economy to the extent that they have something like, and I think it's around 90% food sovereignty now, food security now. Why? Because they've introduced programs over the last 10, 12, 13 years that have given the power over production to around 70% of the country's population, 70% of Nicaragua's economy is generated by small and medium-sized and micro producers,
right?
Mainly agricultural producers.
Yep.
So when people criticize Nicaragua, oh, well, they haven't nationalized their industry, or they haven't socialized this or that. And what they've actually done is they've put economic power into the hands of the huge impoverished majority in the country that was previously excluded from not just political, having a decisive political say, but excluded from a decisive say in how the economy is run.
Right.
And what happened in 2018, and this is a good example of the way US and European Union policy in the region is entirely counterproductive, instead of going along and accompanying these kind of very positive changes to the kinds of changes that we've seen over 50 years in Cuba, the kinds of same changes that we've seen over the last 20 or so years in Venezuela, kind of changes that we've seen in Nicaragua over the last 10, 12, 13 years. Very positive social changes whereby the wealth of the countries concerned is used to focus on the needs of the human person among the population of the majority population of those countries. And instead of promoting those processes, the European Union and the United States act to sabotage them and derail them and destroy them.
Yep, absolutely. And, because what's happening? So go ahead.
What happened in 2018 in Nicaragua is a perfect example of the counterproductive effect of those U.S. policies. The United States and its European allies backed a tiny minority opposition in the country, who had something like 20%. They had something like 20% support,
right,
in the polls at the time, much less now. But at the time, they had between 20-25% solid support as an opposition in the opinion polls. And that opposition tried to overthrow the government, which is always represented in North American and European media as peaceful protest, but it was extremely violent. And they tried to overthrow the government, failed. Among the opposition, allied with the opposition, was the private business sector organization called COSEP. And COSEP's leaders openly supported this attempt to overthrow the government after they themselves had been treated as principal equal partners with the government in the formation and the formulation of economic policy in the country from 2007 until 2018, when they decided to throw over the table and try and bring down the government. Well, they failed.
Yep.
What happened as a result? What happened as a result was that they have now been excluded from the formulation of economic policy. And economic policy is now dominated by the organizations representing small and medium-sized businesses.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so, it's inevitable, right? I mean, they don't allow that kind of diversity when they have control, first of all. They don't share anything with anybody. And when they are on the outs, they will do anything to get back in, except to do a better job of serving the people than the people they're trying to displace. Once they get in, they go back to the same game they were playing before. They're gone for a reason. They extracted the last drop of blood out of those people, as far as the last drop that they're going to be allowed to take. And so when people get complacent and forget, it wasn't so bad, I mean, let me get rid of these guys because they're a pain in the neck, whatever it is that happens that allows conservative, whatever the hell they tried to call it, to happen for a minute, including aggressive manipulation of the processes by the monster United States in those countries. 2 minutes after they go in, they're true to form, they do the same thing, and where the people are allowed to express themselves, they throw them the hell out again. You know, but not for nothing, by the way, that it was 2 million in the last 5 or 6 years, but since 2011, when the program was first announced by Hugo Chavez, the late Hugo Chavez, they've built 3 million housing units in Venezuela.
Right.
And they've been under sanctions the entire time for that last 10 years. And they have 3 million public housing units built since then. That's more than three times the amount of what they have in the United States for one-tenth of the population. So maybe you don't have to seize the private housing stock if you're building a public housing stock for people so they don't need the private housing stock. And that's kind of the model when you're talking about these people that say, why aren't they nationalizing this or doing that? If the people have control of an alternate economy themselves, you don't have to do that.
Right, exactly. And there's so many examples of this. For example, you know, look at Cuba. Cuba's been subject to sanctions for, 60 years now?
Yeah, 61 years.
It's 60 years. Sorry, Don.
Sorry.
And they have just produced, what is it, 3 or 5 vaccines against the...
Yeah, a lot.
The COVID-19 pandemic. Mexico has now decided to several million of those vaccines. Nicaragua will be receiving 7 million of those vaccines because the vaccine, this particular, I think it's the Abdala vaccine from Cuba, that they produced, requires three injections to reach maximum effectiveness. So although Nicaragua's population is only 6 million, they're importing 7 million of these Abdala vaccines
to be able to
vaccinate something over 2 million of their people. And whatever you think about the vaccines, I have serious questions about in particular the mRNA vaccines.
Right.
But I mean, the mere fact that a country that has been under 60 years of sanctions and very severe sanctions that have caused extreme hardship among the Cuban people for all that time, they're still able to make the bio industries of advanced countries in Europe look stupid.
Yep.
And Cuba is a population of what, 11 million?
Yeah, 11, 12 million, and something like that, yeah.
You have this tiny country by comparison with the major Western countries and making them look absolutely stupid in terms of, you know, their ability to meet the pharmaceutical needs of their population. You know, and because the vaccines in Cuba are free, right?
Right.
So, and the same in Nicaragua. All the vaccines that Nicaragua has got, and I'm sure this is also the case in Venezuela, have been free. So, we'll see in the election. And it's likely that in Daniel Ortega and the Sandinista Front here in Nicaragua will win the elections with well over 60% of the vote, possibly over 70%. We'll see. In Venezuela, there's likely to be a similar outcome with a strong majority for the PSUV candidates and related parties, allied parties, in the regional and municipal elections that they'll be having in November. And who knows what's going to happen in the legislative elections in Argentina, because there's a lot of discontent in Argentina. It's even possible that the right wing might make a comeback there because of all kinds of factors that are too complicated to go in right now. I think it's more important to move on to other things that are happening in the region. For example, if one looks at, so we can say that in Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, certainly the United States is likely to suffer setbacks in over the next few months. For example, in Cuba, they've just announced that they, despite everything that the United States and its allies have done to them, Cuba will grow by about 2.2%. Its economy will grow by about 2.2% over the next year or so.
Yep.
So, you can see the United States being very unsuccessful in its policy in those countries, but you can also see what's happening, and they're trying to foment another kind of attempted coup against the government of Bolivia, where President Luis Arce is up against attempts by the right-wingers in the Santa Cruz province, led by, I think it's Luis Camacho, who's an out-and-out fascist, they're trying to resist attempts by the government to consolidate and maintain the rights of indigenous people nationally. And the Santa Cruz right wing, or Santa Cruz fascists more correctly, are trying to challenge that. And it's not clear to me at the moment what the balance of power is likely to be there. And because, and as you know, in the last, I think it was the regional and municipal elections in Bolivia, Luis Arce's government didn't do as well as they might have hoped, but and the right wing did quite strongly, especially in the regions where they've traditionally in their traditional strongholds. So it's not clear to me how that is likely to pan out, but I suspect that in most countries in the region, people want stability, and anybody that tries to threaten stability or destabilize the country is not likely to be well received at a national level. So I suspect that the Bolivian government will be able to, it might take some time, it'll be very complicated, but I think they will be able to suppress and outmaneuver the attempts by the regional right wing in Santa Cruz to bring the country to another crisis. But we'll see. That's just another example of the way the United States never gives up. The United States and its European allies will never give up trying to destabilize progressive governments that actually meet the needs of their people. Right. Because why? Because the priority of the United States and European governments is to serve the elites, the corporate elites to whom they answer, and the interests of the corporate elites in countries like Bolivia lie in, as you said, stealing everything that can't be nailed down.
Right.
So that's what's happening in Bolivia, another area of where United States influence is very visibly challenged is in the protests against their right wing allies. For example, and let's talk a little bit about Ecuador and Chile. The recent revelations of the so-called Pandora Papers have led to political crises in Ecuador and in Chile, because the respective presidents of those countries, Guillermo Lasso in Ecuador and Sebastián Piñera in Chile, figured very prominently in the revelations about how the region's elites take their money out of the country, don't invest in their own country, and often the resources that they have got stashed away in these offshore tax havens, as revealed by the Pandora Papers, come from very shady transactions or even outright illicit transactions.
Right.
And so what's happening in Ecuador is that the legislature there has brought an administrative case against Lasso, and he's going to have to go and explain himself to the Ecuadorian legislature and justify the fact that he had all these resources stashed away in foreign tax havens. And the same is going to happen to Sebastián Piñera. The Chilean legislature has instituted administrative measures that will lead to Sebastián Piñera having to make a declaration to the, I think it's the Senate in Chile, I'm not sure, to justify the resources that he had stashed away over in overseas. So, and those two events are taking place in the context of widespread social protest, and notoriously in Chile. And over the last 2 years, there have been very serious street protests that to the point where even the Chilean authorities were forced to concede the formation of a constituent assembly. That is still underway in Chile, and there are likely to be continuing street protests in Chile around the whole issue of government corruption. Now that this revelation has come out of Sebastián Piñera, and you can be sure that some of his government colleagues and political associates as well have been revealed to be stashing their money away outside the country in what may well be an illicit way. And the same is true in Ecuador. I suspect that Piñera is more secure in Chile than Lasso is in Ecuador. In Ecuador as well, they're developing popular protests against all the measures, all the right-wing measures that he was obviously going to take once he got into power, and he has gone ahead and done that. And he's privatizing stuff and opening up the economy to foreign corporations in a way that is not in the best interests of the majority of people in Ecuador. So, the reasons why that's happening, the immediate reasons are less important than what it represents in terms of a regional trend. And what that represents in terms of a regional trend is that U.S. allies in the region are extremely precarious. You know, their position is not solid and secure, certainly not as solid and secure as the United States and its European allies would like. And you can see that, for example, in Brazil, where Jair Bolsonaro is making all kinds of statements vis-a-vis the elections to be held in 2022, and it's an open question whether he or his military allies might try and stage a coup in the country before the elections. It's an open question whether he'll accept the election result, because all the signs are that Lula da Silva, although he's well into his 70s now, will be the most popular candidate and is very likely to win those elections in Brazil. So all these things indicate the U.S. attempts to prevent a decline or a deterioration in its control and influence in the region are not going well.
And, you know, again, when you're looking at a situation where, you know, the way they're looking, I'm going to use China as an example, China is, you know, ascendant, you know, almost on a trajectory that's been unseen in human history before. And they have to be looking at the fact that, you know, if they're going to have to fight, it's not going to ever be a better situation moving forward. They're only going to be more and more disadvantaged. And as disadvantaged as they are, like in all around the world, it's hard to paint them, you know, in that way when they've got, you know, hundreds of military bases, trillions of dollars of equipment, and, you know, a whole class of compradors, you know, around the world that would embarrass Rome. But they are, because, in fact, underneath all of it, the entire foundation of their structure is collapsing, and there is an alternate one that's being born almost by itself. And they feel like they have to strike. And if they do that, then they have to hold it. And we come back to this same moment, only with everything exaggerated even further. And I think that that's kind of what we're looking at going forward. So we're just about out of time. I would like, I guess, sometime before November 7th, I guess, one of these conversations focus on some of the details of the Nicaraguan election. And I understand you'll be hosting some of our friends down there, or visiting with some of our friends as they pass through to observe the elections. And maybe we can talk about some of that, too.
Yeah, I look forward to that, Don. Let's try doing that next time.
Very good. Thank you, Stephen. And thank you for everything today. Appreciate it, as always.
Okay, you're very welcome. Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.